KFMU DJ Eli Campbell here. One thing that makes Steamboat special is how many awe-inspiring people call our valley home. You could find yourself in line at the coffee shop next to an Olympian or sitting on the gondola next to the founder of a world-renowned business. Our community produces and attracts the best of the best in their respective fields, but most are so humble about it, you would never know. These extraordinary people are the common folk in the boat. Welcome again to Common Folk in the Boat. I'm Eli Campbell, DJ for 104.1, 105.5 KFMU. Joined, as always, by my good friend David Whitlinger of Billow. We start everyone, and you're always just laughing.
You make me laugh. You look at me, and you laugh, and I wonder, do I have something on my face? Did I forget to wipe my mouth? Why are you laughing at me? Just because I'm smiling.
It's just because you are a positive person.
Most people say it's really fun to see you, Dave, because you're always smiling.
Yeah.
And you just laugh at me. Way to go.
I've known you long enough. We are here at the Commons Food Hall, where we are doing another installment of our interview series, highlighting the positive people in Steamboat that have helped make this community what it is. And we've got a unique guest today that has a different perspective than some of the previous guests that we've had about that. And we'll get to her in just a moment. But first, one of the reasons that you are here is because Billow is a great sponsor of ours and really likes to share the positive vibes of Steamboat. So what is Billow thinking positive about right now?
Well, first of all, I'm going to back up. So the only reason we're here is really because I just wanted to be on the show.
Well, that's
so
true.
I had to figure out a way to do it.
We slid in there.
Wanted to hang out with my buddy Eli.
Yeah.
No, I think the segment that we like to call it is what is Billow high on, right? We like to play up that. No, just, but in all seriousness, as I was thinking on the drive over today, I mean, there's nothing specific that Billow has going on, but I will say this, we're high on this whole community aspect right now. You know, Music Fest, I mean, just think about music in general. You know, we've got incredible access to artists. Music Fest just finished up. We've got, you know, Winter Wondergrass coming down the pike. I've been talking with the folks at the Steamboat Freak Summer Concert Series, and they're kind of dripping a few names. Nothing's set yet, but like this idea that, I don't know, our community specific to the music space is just going off. And I love that. I would say Billow is way deep and high on that for sure.
And we of course, really appreciate Billow's support in our series here, Common Folk in the Boat. As I said, we've got a great guest. Someone who has a different perspective, not a perspective of the current people that make Steamboat special, but people that have come through before our time,
the ghosts
that made it the community that we fell in love with. I want to welcome Katie Adams, curator for the Treaded Pioneers Museum. How are you doing today?
Very well, thank you.
Yeah. Well, we go back quite a ways. We've known each other for about 20 years.
Yeah.
And I know you as a person who, this is not the most comfortable setting for you. You're the curator for the Treaded Pioneers. You like to work behind the scenes, as you said, and the underbelly, working on the exhibits at the museum, and you do an incredible job with it. One of those exhibits that you're working on right now is about a family and a man named George Tolles, and it's a part of a series. Can you talk a little bit about that series?
Yeah, the series rotates once a year, and it's called the Foundations of Steamboat Series. And the idea behind it is a way for us to honor local families who've contributed significantly to the history of our area, either generationally or just through major impacts like what we're talking about today. So it's been going on since the late 1990s, probably. And it's featured probably lots of families that you've heard of, Eli, like the Light family from FM Lights, lots of ranching families like the Stankos. Last year, we just finished up with the families of the Rocking Sea Ranch, which is Dockenbaugh, Gray, Allen. So kind of what have they been doing kind of behind the scenes for generations to lay this foundation? So this year, which we opened this Tolles family one here at the beginning of December. And it features, the Tolles family. And they're a little bit different because they don't have maybe such a long generation impact. George and his wife, Marion, came in like 1957, and they were some of the first faculty at what we call Steamboat Mountain School, but then it was called Lowell Whiteman, which was kind of an adventure boarding school, and still is. And he came in with a huge background, but he taught biology, science, history, German, Dutch, Spanish. So he kind of had his hands in a lot of different things. But what he was able to establish there was this international relations kind of curriculum, and started moving students to Mexico to learn there during the off season, and kind of really built what the mission continues to be at that school. So pretty cool.
And I think it's really fitting that that is who you are featuring, because I've heard the names, the Light, Dagenbaugh, the Lockharts, Crawfords. There are a lot of names that you see on street signs around here. Tolles was not a name that I had ever heard. And that's kind of what our series is about the common folk of Steamboat, that some of them maybe people that are doing extraordinary things. And we're talking to a lot of the current people, but people that are doing extraordinary things. But if you met them at a coffee shop or on the gondola, you'd have no idea. And so it's, I like to see that you're highlighting someone that I had been here in town, but had never heard about.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So trying to honor the families so they feel connected to where they've been, but also, yeah, to bring light to, like, there are a lot of people who have been working hard for a long time here.
That's I just to make sure I understand, the Tread is also acts somewhat like the historian of the area, right? I mean, at least you have direct access to a lot of that. So I love that you probably dip into the archives and you find these families that have been entrenched in this community for a long time, and you pull these out. And as Eli said, they're not necessarily household names for me, even though I've been here a little while. Boy, how much fun is that to go to work and make that your job?
Much fun.
I'll bet.
So, and I get really caught up in it. And we have, now that our historic newspapers are digitized, you can spend a lot of time really just reading about these people and finding out stuff. So it's a really interesting job, and rabbit holes like you wouldn't believe.
I bet.
I can only imagine some of the stories that have come out of the newspapers from the 30s, 40s, 50s.
Yes. Yeah. I'll start out like, oh, I want to know about this. And then I'm like, what do you mean there was a murder?
Gunslinging at high noon.
Yeah exactly. Yeah.
Well, from a name that we weren't so familiar with, I think one of the things that, of course, brings a lot of people to Steamboat is the skiing and the ski area. When I moved here, it was a ski town that I was looking for. Now, the reason that I moved to Steamboat was because there was a community here, which I think a lot of ski resorts maybe lack. And so it was the community around the skiing, but the skiing had to be there for me to move somewhere back in that time. And so the history of skiing in Steamboat goes back longer than maybe some people really realize, in that we have the longest operating ski area in North America. And of course, we're not talking about Mount Warner. We're talking about Howlison Hill.
That's right.
The namesake of that, Carl Howlison. So can you talk a little bit about the origins of skiing here in the Valley?
Yeah, absolutely. Because we're just kind of kicking off our ski season. So I think it definitely is fun to talk about. And I think there's a lot of people who know the name Howlison or want to know how to say it.
or spell it.
Yep. E-L. But maybe don't often know, well, who was this guy? And he actually has kind of an exciting, it might be built up now after all these years, background. But he originally from Norway, and his name was Carl Howlison. And he made his way here first to Chicago and had a gig actually working for the Barnum and Bailey Circus. And that's because that's, you know, how little America knew about this crazy sport of ski jumping, which they called like ski sailing. Flying in the air with wood on your legs.
He was the flying Norwegian, right?
Flying Norseman, exactly. And he worked with Barnum and Bailey for quite a while, which is crazy. And I don't know if it's super true, but I still like the story. Like if you can picture under the big top, and they had this ski jump, essentially, that they greased with Vaseline, which I'm like, how much Vaseline?
It's a good legend. Petroleum, you know,
jelly does it take to launch a flying Norseman into the air?
I know you're a historian and you want to work on facts, but sometimes legends need to be legends.
Yeah. Something slippery was applied.
Yeah.
And he would go down the something slippery, they say, and then off of it and like over the backs of the elephants and land in the arms of the strong man.
That's
I've got a visual in my head right now that I wish I was an artist and I could paint.
Yeah.
Right? I could see that.
With his mustache.
I'm not sure I remember that part of the Greatest Show movie that came out recently.
Me either. But they did. Remember the posters in that movie? Which were a big deal. So that part is historically accurate. And actually, if you've seen the Barnum and Bailey posters around town, Barnum and Bailey actually gave the Tread of Pioneers copyright in the 1990s. So we're able to reprint it exclusively. So if you ever see it, there is some fact and history in that. Anyway, he got hurt. We go figure. It was like the most, they say, you know, the most popular act, but he got injured and eventually decided to come find snow in Colorado and made it as far as Hot Sulphur Springs and thought that that was pretty good. And then a woman named Marjorie Perry was on the train watching him. And she was like, no, brother, come on the other side. We have a lot of snow. And he did. He was like, this place is amazing. And from the, you know, writings and things that we have at the museum, people, especially children, were completely enamored with this guy. And he was teaching kids to jump off roofs and
love it.
Yeah. Building things.
He was
building
the first.
Jumps.
He was the first, like, what, bad influencer, right? Hey, kids, come here. Let me show you how this works.
Exactly.
Get up on that roof. Yeah.
Exactly. So people just lost their minds because before it was just like, I used these, like, planks of wood that they called snowshoes to check my cattle. And that was about it. So he really transformed, you know, winter survival into winter enthusiasts. And it just snowballed from there. Yeah, we like that.
Oh, you need your applause button.
Boom. So from there, you know, obviously then we start skiing on Hallison Hill. There was Woodchuck Hill where they would be jumping off of as well. He inspired many others from his kind of trip to Hot Sulphur Springs and then chance meeting to come here. And then you move into John Steele and Gordon Wren and beyond.
Yeah, exactly. This guy who was just a little boy at the time, watches Carl Hallison ski jump and starts to learn from him, eventually sees his career and keeps going with it and is our first Olympian. In 1932, we went to Lake Placid for jumping and it comes back and does like, you know, a school auditorium, like I went and he's got his USA sweater on and cap and mittens, which are very cool that the museum still has. Thank you, John Steele, for giving those to the museum eons ago. But it's really cool to see the first uniform. Anyway, in the auditorium is a little boy who was also born and raised here named Gordon Wren. And he was like, that's what I want to do. And so he starts learning from John Steele, who learned from Carl. And it kind of just keeps going like that. And Gordon Wren really was an anomaly in the skiing world at the time. I mean, we're talking like the 1940s, so it's still pretty early. And he actually qualified for the 1942 Olympics, but they were canceled because of World War II. Right. So he never made it to that one. But he qualified, which is unheard of today, in all things skiing.
Wow.
So they called it a four-way skier and was the best, like they say, ever known. So he qualified in Nordic, in jumping, which would also be cross country, slalom, and downhill.
Wow. So
can you imagine?
He's the first of many Olympians here in Steamboat. And if you, I mean, it's amazing because now you're specialized in Nordic. You're specialized.
Yeah,
in
you don't really come out.
Yeah.
And he actually goes on to enlist in World War II himself and joins the 10th Mountain Division and starts training paratroopers. There were a lot of people from Steamboat Springs that moved into that the 10th Mountain Division, because they did have the skiing and kind of mountaineering background. And he eventually makes it to the 48 Olympics and gets to choose.
So did he choose a discipline, or was he still a four-way skier?
He qualifies in all and then decides to go in Nordic combined. Okay. Like, yeah. They're like, what team you want to be on, Gord?
What an amazing opportunity. I mean, nowadays it's gotten so specialized that even someone who does I don't even know, the alpine, the combined, where they do the downhill and the slalom, even that is like very, very specialized, difficult to do, because these skiers pick a discipline and that is what they focus on. So back in the day, I love hearing that it was a little different in the sense that these athletes could qualify in multiple areas.
Exactly. Cool. Yeah. It was pretty unheard of. And he did really well and had the highest like placement in jumping, which is still like one of the highest an American has ever placed in Nordic jumping. Anyway,
and that all pretty cool. That all traces back to Carl Halson, and then moving forward to the names that you do start to recognize and to know from Mount Werner and the Werner family.
So. Yes. So after Gordon comes back from World War II, he comes back here to Steamboat Springs and starts getting involved in coaching at the Werner Sports Club. And he has this like crop of kids that are amazing. <I bet. laughs> thanks to his like dedication and enthusiasm for the sport, but also, I mean, he's just well trained, and he trains them also in all the disciplines.
Well, sorry, I just want to, and I don't want to get off topic, but I've seen at the Tread of Pioneers photos, you know, old historic remarks about how our kids, our community kids, would ski to school, right? I mean, these kids would literally use that as a mode of transportation. So I guess what I'm saying is, it doesn't surprise me that you've got this incredible group of skiers, because whether they do it for sport or for just a means of transportation, these kids are on skis. And this is back when they were wooden and straps, leather straps. Not surprise me that we produced, you know, that level of athlete when that's what they were born with.
I know. And we think of like, night skiing is kind of a new thing. They brought in night skiing in the 30s to Hallison Hill. Again, Mount Werner wasn't yet an idea, but so they spent a lot of time on the snow, and Gordon produced these guys that we know today, all three Werner siblings, which would be the oldest was Skeeter. And they say like she was by far the most edgy and competitive of the three of them.
Sure.
She really set the bar. And then comes Buddy, and then little brother Loris, I think, is like 8 years younger than Skeeter. And all three of them end up going to the Olympics. Another guy, Marv Crawford, was a four-way skier as well. So he competed in jumping and Nordic combined, but he could also do downhill. And he had a son that went to the Olympics. And so there's like about 10 or 11 kids that Gordon Wren coach to the Olympic level.
So what I think is incredible about your perspective here is that you have all of these people that, again, they trace back to Carl Halson, but they were just common kids of Steamboat following in the footsteps of somebody else and somebody else, becoming the Olympians of Steamboat, becoming these, you know, not just community-wide known, but really nationally and internationally known skiers.
Yeah.
Can you talk a little bit more about how kind of Buddy Werner and Skeeter ended up going to the Olympics and those sorts of things?
Yeah, exactly. I think you could argue that like it made it seem possible because they all knew someone who had done it and showed them that it was possible. So there was never any doubt that you couldn't go to the Olympics from this tiny town. I mean, we're still, you know, in the mid 50s. So the population of the entire county was still like less than 3,000 people. Like we're still really tiny. And then all of that kind of changed when Buddy Werner started winning junior events. Gordon Wren starts taking them, you know, to regional meets and things like that and competitions, and he qualifies for, you know, the next step, and it just kind of grows from there. And Buddy was doing so in ski jumping as well. And makes it onto the U.S. ski team and starts actually competing with European racers, which no one had ever heard of an American even being in the circuit.
Let alone from a community of 3,000 people in Northwest Colorado.
Yeah.
I'm fascinated because I've known a little bit of this history, but it's just now it's a light bulb in my head just going off like, oh my gosh, the uphill battle, if you will, of how this all transpired to become an international competitive team out of little old Steamboat Springs.
Yeah. To have crazy. 10 people doing
so
it.
So cool.
Exactly.
Well, and I always think too, back to the travel back then, it's not like it was a hop on I-70, a flight to DIA or anything like that. You know, just the amount of dedication it would take to travel to Europe to compete.
Yeah.
And know that you had the hometown support behind you, but they might not even get the news for a week after.
They didn't get the news. They didn't get to come. And, you know, we have Buddy's mother, her name was Hazy, also born and raised here, kept pretty detailed scrapbooks. And she has a lot of international papers that I think people would mail. And that is kind of what really gave me the perspective of going through these old yellowed newspapers is like, holy cow, he was a big deal here. Obviously, you would think he'd be covered in our paper, but he was covered in every paper across the world, in every language. And so I think he was an even bigger star over there in Europe than we kind of even realize today.
And it was a big deal internationally when he passed away. 60 years ago, is that right?
60 years ago, here in 2024, we'll be remembering that anniversary, which was pretty tragic. You know, he wasn't very old, not even 30 yet. And I think that made a huge, huge waves in the sports world, but also here in Steamboat Springs. A lot of things were done. His teammates really, really took it hard because at the time you didn't really think that skiing was a sport that could take your life. They were skiing and filming a Willy Bogner ski fashion movie in Switzerland.
Is that like the precursor to Warren Miller?
Yeah. Basically. What
did they have the cool commentary? Yeah. Like Warren's like little jabs?
No, yes. Man. And they had real like edgy music, and they were wearing really
edgy, like big
cool,
band swing.
Yeah, like kind of odd jazzy. And they had a lot of costume changes, of course, because they were selling ski clothes. But I don't think they really understood how to check avalanche concerns yet. And yeah, he and another woman whose name I'm now forgetting, Barbara something German, starts with an H. Anyway, they made it past the first slide, out-skied it, which I cannot even imagine the panic.
Yeah, and on that old equipment as well, out-skiing the slide.
Yeah.
Pretty impressive.
And then a second one was set off, and it overtook them both. So it was really hard. And just like his charisma and the way he handled himself. I mean, most of the time he was just a teenager, but I think that's kind of what sticks with me. Some of his teammates were like Moose Barrows and Billy Kidd. And Billy talks about we didn't want to just ski like Buddy Werner. We wanted to be Buddy Werner. Like the way he carried himself represented Steamboat Springs. And then people started to realize, well, if he came from there, what must this place be like? Which is crazy. And then brings us kind of full circle. In 1956, George Toles was in Innsbruck watching the Olympics and saw this kid, Buddy Werner, competing and learned about him and thought the way he carries himself and what he stands for is so impressive. I need to go find out what this Steamboat Springs place is. So, you know, there isn't anything that you can kind of separate. It all just builds on itself and moves us into the next chapter of everything.
And I think we've been talking about it with the various guests that we're inviting to come talk here on Common Folk is, you know, a lot of people that I've known for 20 years from different aspects of my life. And and how this community is so tight and so interconnected. You'd talk about, we started with George Tolles and how he started Will Whiteman, but he maybe would never have known to come to Steamboat if it weren't for Buddy Werner and if it weren't for Carl Hallison originally coming to Steamboat. And so it's amazing how when you go to the museum and you connect these dots, how you get from what Steamboat was to what it is now and the community that we are now. Can you talk to any of that, you know, the community spirit and just, you know, kind of how it has evolved, but how it has remained the same through the years?
I think some of our annual traditions help keep us kind of rooted in that feeling. And there are a lot of families like the Tolles who kind of continue the same things for us that help us remain that community. They're like second, I don't think we have very many of those families left, second generation of having an entire career at the Steamboat ski area. Their daughter Allison has worked there for 30 years and her mom worked there for 25 years, and just, you know, kind of that consistency of people makes it feel, and also people reminding us like, these place names are these people and these events led to this, and seeing kind of the places that have always been around. It's easy to forget.
You move from Carl Hallison to now a town that has produced more Winter Olympians than any other town. And you look at the Winter Carnival that we have, and over 100 years of Winter Carnival. So it is something that makes Steamboat special. The common people that have come before us and that have done extraordinary things.
Exactly. Yeah.
Well, I appreciate the stories. I know that if you go to the museum, you can learn a whole lot more about this, the Tolles family and all the other different exhibits that you have there. I'd love to dive deeper into it. And I know that I would get far down into that rabbit hole at some point.
Yeah.
But it is, it's amazing. If you've lived here long enough, I think just knowing where you've come from and where the community has come from gives you a better grounding of
absolutely
your kind of place here.
Absolutely.
What do you think?
I mean, I would agree. I would say that I've gone to a lot of small towns across the country, and there's always the tiny little museum, or not always, but there's oftentimes something. And sometimes it's a one room with, you know, one kind of volunteer curator or whatever. And I will say that in Steamboat, maybe this is different, maybe not, but it is legitimate Western history. Like this is a, like Eli said, we could talk for hours. This could be a show in itself. Just, I mean, the history of Steamboat. So no, I appreciate everything you're doing at the Tread.
Absolutely. Yeah. And there's lots of ways you can get involved and check in with us. Here in a next month, I'll be opening a Buddy Werner Memorial exhibit. You can always check in on our website, which is treadpioneers.org. That tells you what events we have going on. Of course, our History Happy Hour series is super popular. That's the first Tuesday of every month at the House and Hill Lodge, because we have so many folks. So you get a free beer. Tasting of whiskey from Mixology.
Say no
when,
more.
When? Wait, yeah. What?
I know. And then because we don't post it, you know, inside the walls at the museum, but it's kind of some of those like seedy, different color stories that we all want to know about.
They might not make an exhibit about it, they make the lore about it.
They go better with a beer, easier to understand. So those are really popular throughout the winter months. Just always a lot going on.
Well, thank you to Katie Adams telling us just a handful of the many, many stories of people that have made this community special. Now, this is a whole series about how there are common folk in Steamboat that have done extraordinary things, and you wouldn't even know it if you were sitting next to them. So I've done my research, and I don't even know if you know it or not, but you are one of five women in the state of Wyoming to have eight individual swimming titles.
Eight?
Yep. Because apparently in Wyoming, you're only allowed to compete in two
That's
races.
Right.
And you You won every single one of your state races from freshman year through senior year.
Nobody ever beat me. I know. Crazy.
So one of five. And and your 500 meter freestyle record stood from 1998 until just a couple of years ago, 2020.
Is so that right?
That yes. is correct. So
that's crazy.
It's one of these things. I know that that's not something you're ever going to go out and share with people, but yeah. sitting next to you, you know, you're just one of these common people that has pretty cool little history there. I think I'm impressed. You.
And it goes to show, if you're a guest on the Common Folk podcast, beware, because Eli's going to sleuth you. He's going to Google
right.
you.
That's right. You never know what I might find. So
thank you.
There you have it. Katie Adams telling us about the Common Folk of the Boat and one herself. So thank you very much.
Thank you.